It's no surprise that updating the electricity grid today will make for a better tomorrow. Increased self-sufficiency is just one of the benefits. The Great Grid Upgrade will also boost the economy and create new green jobs. And best of all, you can continue doing the things you love, like watching the latest epic nature documentary or listening to this podcast while caring for the planet too. Find out more at nationalgrid.com.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now, go.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Plodcast, the nature and countryside podcast from BBC Country Farm magazine. My name is Fergus Collins and I'm the host of the Plodcast. So this is season 9, our homage to spring in Britain as we attempt to visit 12 different habitats to record the wild residents and some equally worthy human inhabitants. And in episode 8, I journey to a completely new habitat for me, the lowland heaths of southern England. I received an invitation from an organisation called ARC, the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust. ARC works hard to protect these wild expanses of heather and scrub for our 6 species of reptile, but especially the rarest of them all, the smooth snake. So, with a lucky break in the May rain, I joined experts Owain Masters, Nick Dobbs, and our own Kevin Parr on a wild ramble across the Dorset Heaths, searching for bits of corrugated iron that the snakes shelter under. And along the way, we encounter some of the wonderful wildlife that can be found in these heathlands. But did we find the snakes? So I've just driven across Somerset and Dorset to East Dorset, where I have arrived at a huge expanse of heathland and woodland, not too far from the south coast, and a gently undulating patchwork of scrub and open sort of heathery, sandy heathery landscape. It's a really interesting corner of the world and somewhere I've never been to. I'm walking on a sandy path which is full of flints, and you've got these great bundles of heather, great clumps, and then on my right a sort of mixture of birch, lots of little birches in the heather. So it's been a really strange spring in many respects, 2021. We've got distant dogs barking. So we had a really dry April, and now we've had a very wet May, and it's mid-May, absolutely midpoint of May now. So it'd be interesting to see how that may have affected this landscape, and in particular the key species that I've come to get to know and hopefully see as the reptiles that live here. One in particular, which is Britain's third snake. So we know about adders and grass snakes, which have featured a lot in our podcasts, but there's a third snake in Britain, which only really lives in these heathy areas,
It's called the Smooth Snake, and weather, it's quite a cool morning. Very fresh smell in the air. It's sort of, you know, it's been raining for several days, but it's clear today, and I'm hoping that the sun will come out shortly. There's a bit of blue sky around now, much more than there was even 20 minutes ago. So with some luck, we'll have some warmth, and potentially warmth and reptiles go together like peaches and cream. So we might get to see some of them coming out. Who knows? I really don't know enough about reptiles, so I'm relying on my host today. It's really a day of adventure. And even as I speak, the light is getting brighter, and there's little tendrils of sunshine. We need that squeaky sound as we squeaky enter the nature reserve. It's an important moment of the Rubicon is crossed. So I'm here with Owain Masters and Nick Dobbs.
Yep.
From ARC.
Yep.
which is Amphibian and Reptile Conservation. So what do you both do for the organisation? Just to set the scene for the listeners.
I work for a project called Snakes in the Heather, which is ARC's flagship project to conserve the smooth snake, so our rarest reptile, and also to conserve and work towards conservation of the heathland habitat on which it depends. And there's two of us within this project, two main members of staff, myself, and I am the education and events officer, and my colleague Ben Limburn, who runs the citizen science, who runs our reptile survey side of things and manages our survey volunteers.
Okay, so it's a big project, protecting these heaths, and the rare reptiles and amphibians.
Exactly that. There have been historic attempts at recording the smooth snake in various places, and in fact ARC's CEO did a series of research a number of years ago. But what the project is really aiming to do is to get everyone in a room together speaking about the smooth snake, so we can actually find out more about its population across its whole range. Historically, there are quite a number of sort of managers of this dry lowland heath, this really important rare habitat. Nick's very heavily involved with some of the urban heaths, and there's us and the RSPB and the National Trust and the councils, and lots of people do their own reptile surveys. And what we really want to do through this project and through data sharing is to get all that information together, so we have this huge picture, so we can actually understand how different impacts at different sites are affecting the populations, and share that all together at the end of the project, so that we can improve the conservation outcomes.
Right, so there's lots of people doing individual work, and you're gathering all these
big part of it is
heroes
the partnership.
Together. Right, and you're one of those.
I've been surveying for ARC since May 2016, and the smooth snake, whilst it's UK's rarest reptile, it is also the most cryptic of all the species that we are trying to understand more about. And
when you say cryptic, do you mean
their ecology, how they behave, is probably the least understood of all six of our native British reptiles, because they are a highly fossorial species. They spend a considerable amount of time underground.
Right.
So open field observations of their behaviour is, even today, surprisingly, somewhat limited. And so through survey work, we begin to understand some of their dispersal habits, certainly, through the survey work that we do.
Right. So you're basically saying we don't know much about the third snake, Britain's third snake.
That's a fair comment. We don't, and as I said, it's because largely the open field observations of them are somewhat limited. To be able to understand how their behaviour works, you do need to see that more often. Mm. But certainly we can understand, as Owen was saying, about, you know, where they're distributed, how they're faring on the sites that they're known to exist on, and more importantly, the sites we don't know where they are.
Right,
and that's another factor as part of this big project.
Kevin at this stage. Kevin Parr, who listeners will know from many other podcasts, but you've found smooth snakes.
I did. And we've been chatting this morning, Nick and I, because about 7 or 8 years ago, I found a smooth snake on a local nature reserve where there simply shouldn't be any. And I mentioned it, and this snake's, it's known, and Nick knew all about it, which was quite nice.
Kevin Parr's smooth snakes. The legend.
It's legendary. And I finally get to meet the guy who encountered it, which is amazing.
So have they been seen since there?
No. I mean, I surveyed there myself for 2 or 3 years until I got bitten by a tick that wasn't too friendly, or carried something not too friendly.
Oh dear. Did you get limes?
I did, yeah. I've been treated for it. They couldn't really say for sure, but so I had to stop the surveying, which is a shame. But no sign since. But
Nick, you're saying that there's lots of heathlands where I should just describe where we are and maybe do fill in the blanks, because
morning.
More local inhabitants. And so we've got really a sort of, it is open heathland here, but with sporadic trees, mostly birch by the look of things, is that right?
That's correct. I mean, yeah. Birch is the most familiar of the trees that you see in lowland heathland. They are the tree that begins to afforest, I think that's the right term. But it's a mosaic of habitat. NARC have done a considerable amount of work on here to actually improve the habitat for all six of our native reptile species, which are found here.
All here? All six
of them, yeah.
I mean, that's a challenge for a day.
I know.
As we're looking across here, you can see the hillside over there, and you can see that they've actually put in some extensive sand scrapes. And that work was done several years ago.
Sand scrapes. So that's
can you see where the sort of sandy, stony effect that is along across by the pathway
over
there?
A mini raised stone wall.
It looks like a spoil heap. Now, if you actually were to walk along those, you will see sand lizards because it's their ideal habitat to be able to lay their eggs. They are oviparous. So they are wholly dependent on...
So they're the only ones that lay eggs, are they?
Of the British reptiles? Yeah. No, the grass snake does as well. Right, yeah. Okay. I mean, there's three types of egg-laying. There's oviparous, ovoviparous, and viviparous. Yeah. Viviparous is live-bearing, essentially, and oviparous is to some extent, but...
You lay the eggs inside you.
Correct,
I thought I heard a Dartford.
Oh, really? Okay.
There's Dartford warbler on here, too.
Okay, because that would be good.
And nightjar.
It looks very nightjarish.
Yes,
it's a terrific sight.
Gosh, was it good?
When you create the scrape, so as well as creating that patch of sand that will give access to the sand lizards, those animals, as an area to make their nest, it also itself breaks up the area and can become used then for basking as well. And quite a lot of the reptiles, so you have the heather, but if you have patches, if you have footpaths, raised banks, things like that, you quite often find that reptiles quite like to bask. The mosaic basket sort of interfaces between a path and a habitat, because they can come out into the open that little bit more and get that bit warmer, but then they have the safety of somewhere they can shoot off. So something like a bank and a footpath also does that, and particularly south-facing.
Yeah, I was just
bank.
Thinking south-facing. Yeah. So
warmer.
And obviously we're in May. The heather is looking quite dowdy, I would say. It's not as people would imagine. But this is a different species of heather to what I live in the Brecon Beacons, mm-hmm. and a lot of people will be familiar with moorland heather. Is this a different species down here?
This site actually has four species of heather. So there are three heather that you commonly get on, well, more commonly get on the dry lowland heath, even though it's not a common habitat. But this, there are those three, the ones that prefer slightly drier, slightly wetter in this middle ground. But on this particular site and further along here, in a different time of year when it's in flower, there's a fourth type called Dorset Heath. So there is a rare type that's only around
specific
the
specific to Dorset. Well, okay, gosh.
And it's this heather is part of the reason why heathland is such a good habitat for reptiles, because mentioning earlier the trees, it can become afforested. So heather is a low-lying shrub, so it can provide a layer of cover, it can provide shelter, food, warmth, everything that the reptile needs, but it's also not going to create so much shade that they lose that ability to bask. So that's why heathland itself becomes such a good habitat, that warmth in that layer and that ability to shelter as well.
So talking about this rare habitat, there's not much of it.
It's quite fragmented now here. This is the Great Heath that went from Dorchester right across to sort of Christchurch almost. and then further south, right down through Purbeck. And we're somewhere on it. But yes. It used to be enormous, and it's fragmented largely through a lot of building work and
urbanisation.
Yeah.
But it's actually the ability to be able to disperse and to be able for what we call clades of reptiles to be able to interact and disperse. Clades are like sort of little populations within populations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on this site, for example, we may have a population of smooth snakes over in that direction. We may have a population of smooth snakes over in that direction. If they're genetically going to do well, then there should be the ability to be able to connect between
those. The clades need to meet.
Yeah. Clades need to meet, yeah. The clans.
Yeah,
clans,
great.
Clan of the smooth snakes.
Well, this is interesting. Yeah, I like it. So I should say we're just moving through the little holly here, but it's mostly heather, spiky gorse, as I can feel in my ankles here. This is an ant's nest. This is a wood ant.
Yeah, big wood ant's nest, yeah. So
this is incredible. I've not seen one of these for a long time. So the massive... And these ants put your household ants to shame. These are like the sort of Goliaths of our ant world. There's a sort of gentle rustle in the background of several hundred ants just moving around on this 70 centimetres high mound. It's
certainly a big one.
Yeah, that's great.
That's for sure.
What an incredible thing. Just out here, and they're wood ants, but this is out in the heath.
Yeah.
Nick is now donning gloves, which is an exciting moment.
Well, we're going to go and have a look. One of the things about when you're surveying, and particularly if a site hasn't been surveyed for a while, you've probably been wondering why for about 5 minutes I've been going around in circles. A particular pin or refugia that I'm looking for is not where I was expecting it to be. So we're going to go and find another one, which I know is definitely there.
You're involved with all the other lowland heath reserves as well, are you, around?
A huge amount. Through Snakes in the Heather, there are more than 30 partners signed up to take part in the training and disseminate the training and share the research with us. So it's enormously beneficial to have all those people involved. We're really, really grateful for that. And that's something that happened over the development of the project.
So there's a bit of corrugated iron in the heather here that Nick has...
So here is one of the refugia or tins on this site here. So I'm wearing a glove here, very, very strong garden glove. And there's very good reason for that because we do have adder on the site here. Mm. So I'm going to turn this one over.
Exciting moment.
This is the most exciting.
There's lots of ants.
So we don't have a smooth snake under here on this instant, but there is something interesting that I do want to point out. We have a number of species of ants on this site, and with the exception of the slow worm, generally speaking, our native British reptiles don't do terribly well alongside ants. But what we see here are red ants.
Yeah.
And don't ask me for the Latin names of those, because I actually don't know.
Scurrying around, sort of.
And as we go into further into the spring, when the ants start to create their colonies, more and more frequently you do see ant nests under there. But we have a number more tins to be able to look at in the hope of finding a smooth snake. So
I have very well managed expectations in life, but I am getting some levels of built, definitely. And we've seen some good ants.
I do the education and events as well. You do at the beginning of any education or event that involves a reptile, you start with the caveat that there might not be a reptile, but promise that there's lots of other beautiful wildlife and things you can talk about, but they are, of course, very cryptic.
So here you're marking out this...
Absolutely. So what I'm doing is...
it's a Dartford warbler just in this gorse, just nearby.
It's singing as well, which is there. That is it.
Sorry to interrupt.
So that's the song. Can you see it, Kevin?
I could see it, yes. There it is.
Sitting
nicely now.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, lovely.
And again, a dart warbler, rather like the smooth snake in many ways. In fact, that's an incredible shoot.
It's got a reddish, terracotta-y sort of breast and throat and a red eye and a grey, they're actually blue-grey back. Lovely.
Limited to these sort of areas, although they're doing a lot better in recent years, but they're quite common on spots like this, whereas you can go, you know, 5 miles in another direction where the habitat isn't right and not see a single one. But in areas like this,
there it is, right on top. What a beautiful bird. You're saying about recording, do you have all these, because that square of corrugated iron, it's not very big, so it's sort of a metre by 50 centimetres.
They, ARC use a range of different refugia. This particular refugia you're looking at now is one that has been down, I don't actually know the answer to how long it's been down.
It's an ancient refugia.
At least going into probably a couple of decades.
Corrugated Iron Age.
Yeah, corrugated Iron Age. You know, when we actually go and we survey the tins, there is a number of bits of information that we collect. And it's important to stress that just because there wasn't a reptile under that tin doesn't mean that the record is not valuable to us. Mm. None, as I'm putting down here, nothing spotted, is actually just as important as finding something under a tin, because it gives us an idea and a track record over the time period of doing the surveys as to the frequency. Mm. And the other bits of information that we typically check is, well, what is the cloud cover? And we have a very simple scheme of naught, one and two as defining weather. Naught means it's brilliant blue skies, one means it's partially cloudy, two means it's heavily clouded.
So today is today a one day?
Today is a one, so well spotted, so you're now an expert on the cloud cover. In terms of rain, similarly, naught, one and three, so naught will mean there's no rain, one, there's a little bit of drizzle, and two, it's pelting down. I will try and demonstrate it.
Fantastic.
And now what I've got to do is to try and be quiet for a second and see if I can go and find another tin.
Do you have to remember where they all are, or do you have them plotted on them?
I have them plotted on a GPS here. We have, ARCA have a very, very rigorous system in terms of the retention of the GPS coordinate.
Well, we've wandered through and it is trackless.
Yes.
Not giving away the size of the reserve, but there's a lot of land here.
It's huge.
Another Dartford. Checking away.
Is that a Dartford checking? That's because that would I would have assumed that was a stone chat.
That is a stone chat. Yeah. You know, oh my word, it's
okay.
A stone chat.
No, that's okay. We can keep that bit in now.
No, take that out. I'll swear.
Oh, so that's the array of. So Owen is showing me a map of the reserve and how evenly spaced out all these. It's got all the little yellow squares where all the refugia are. Well, it looks pretty densely covered like that, but I'm guessing in the real world it's, as you say, 75 metres between each one. So.
Yeah. Folks, just over here is a stone chat.
Oh, yes. Is that making that chucking noise?
It's funny enough, yeah. It's very distinct.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't get it wrong with any other bird on the heath. That lovely sound of two little rocks being smacked together. Nick has something. It doesn't look like a snake, it's got something in his hand.
I saw Kevin earlier on talking about the different wildlife that we're seeing as we go around. And that's the thing, I mean, refugia work is scientific, it is important, and that data is important. But actually, perhaps the greatest joy comes from open field observational work, non-disturbance based. Because if you open your eyes, you can suddenly find creatures like this.
Fabulous. Dung beetle, is it? Is it dung beetle?
I'm not sure. I don't think it is. I'm not a beetle expert.
Oh, look at that. That's
but it's
beautiful.
Got this beautiful, if you look at its legs, it's got this incredible green and purple iridescence to it.
Yeah, and it's the shiniest beetle I've ever seen in Britain.
Yeah, that is incredible.
So it's kind of a little, fully armoured, was an inch long.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. I want to say door beetle, but I'm not 100% certain.
It feels to me like as a child, I was an absolute massive beetle fan, and that's the insects.
You don't go far back as John Ringo. No.
And I I was a nerd, a coleopterist nerd, and I think that looks like a dung beetle of some description to me.
It could there well. There are dung beetles on heaths, yeah, certainly. Yeah, you do see a lot of them in the very late summer, early autumn.
Yeah, what's creating the dung for them is the...
It's areas where there's grazing regime, but there's also quite a lot of these... Quite a lot of the heathlands are managed as enclosures, and you do often have deer, various kinds of deer, introduced deer and native deer. And so in some of those sites, it's the deer that are creating the dung.
Right. Good find. Lovely find.
I'm going to... Right. So we have arrived at another...
It's peering through the heather.
And I'm going to lift this one. The common lizard has just gone running off there.
So we've got some reptile activity today.
Activity. And I'm going to lift the tin with my glove on. And here we have a smooth snake.
Fantastic.
A smooth snake. My goodness. Wow.
And there you go.
Well, I have never seen a smooth snake.
Now, I'm taking my glove off because I know that this is not,
it's not gonna bite
venomous.
No.
They do actually bite, but it's not not painful.
It's beautiful. It's a brown snake with gentle markings. And how would you describe it, actually, Nick?
Well, I think one of the most obvious features about the smooth snake is it's got this series of mostly dots and dashes that run down the back.
Its tongue is flicking out in a very acceptable, sneaky fashion.
It's tasting the air. Now, interestingly, these dots and these dashes are the things that help us to identify individual specimens.
Right, so that's its unique code, its barcode, as it were.
And I can say with 100% certainty that I've encountered this particular individual before, yeah. With 100% certainty, and that's the reason for that is because the top... dash, for want of a better term, I recognise the one nearest the head. It is a shape that I have seen before.
Is that the dash at the base of its head?
Yeah, there's a dash. So you've got the head, but behind the head, going down the length of the body, you've got this series of side by side, largely little spots, sometimes dashes that run all the way down the back. So when we're doing survey work, and this is part of the training that's offered by ARC, we actually take photographs of the individual snakes so that we actually have a database. I'll be interested to see what you think, whether this is male or female.
So looking at Nick's holding the snake, Kev is...
But you see where its tail is, you can take some calculations, and tail length's a good indicator of what gender.
So tail length, so you're talking about the part after the vent.
There's a calculation that we use.
The vent
that has been based on, it's just about to do a little poop, this one, so I'm just holding it a little bit away from me. They don't spray like grass snakes per se.
Do they have smelly?
Not particularly.
I mean, I'm very familiar with slow worms. I have gardens full of them. And,
grass snakes take it to a whole new level. Slow worm poop stinks a bit. This you can smell it, but it's not noxious.
How would you describe it? I've not got a great sense of smell this morning, so how would you describe it?
Would you like me to sniff its bottom?
I would love you to sniff its bottom.
Fragrant is the word.
Fragrant. Okay. What does it eat then? To provide.
They are primarily reptiles eating specialists, so they focus on other reptiles.
Really?
Not exclusively.
But they'll eat other snakes or lizards.
It is documented that they will predate on young adders. They certainly predate on lizards, from sand lizards, slow worms.
They look so innocent.
They look so innocent.
Teddy bear eyes.
Very gentle. Going back, to the sexing.
Yeah.
I mean, Owain is absolutely right on this because this, I believe, is male.
It is male.
Okay, actually. And what we do is to take a measurement of the entire length of the snake. Mm-hmm. And we then take a measurement...
Which is tricky when it's a muscular coiling...
It is, but I will demonstrate that in a second.
We have hand sanitizer.
Okay.
So we measure the entire length of the snake, and we then measure from the vent to the end of the tail. So from the cloaca, which is, as you can see, some nice poo coming out now,
right,
to the end of the tail. And then it's a calculation of that divided into the total length of the snake to give a percentage.
Right. Got you.
The bulge above, that's the sexual organs, isn't
hemipenes,
it?
Unlike humans, reptiles, snakes, they have two willies, basically, called hemipenes. And you're absolutely right, that... area around the cloaca is one of the identifying features in many reptiles. If it has a sort of a bulge around that area, it looks wider,
then I think whilst we're discussing its
genitalia,
its visuals, but it might be worth saying how it has its Latin, why it has its Latin name. Oh. So it's Coronella ostracacia. I think I've said that
ostracacia.
Right.
Coronella ostracacia.
Okay. How do you say it?
I say ostrica, but
Coronella ostrica, but the coronella, so the crown. So you can see it has that heart shape. On its head, so there's an identifying feature.
These large
feature.
Scales.
Yeah, those large scales that are that slightly darker brown on top of its head, in that kind of heart shape. That's the coronella.
It is, as with all reptiles, deliciously softened.
Yep.
It is absolutely a beautiful.
Isn't
creature.
It beautiful?
So I've got lots of questions, but my first one is, how do they catch their reptile prey?
I suppose. The best way of describing it is that they are effectively a constrictor in that respect. Right. So obviously they don't use envenomation to capture their prey, and so they grab it and then they coil around.
So do they wait? Do they ambush predators? Do they sort of?
Going back to that point about how they behave, I would probably suspect that smooth snakes go in search of their prey. I'm sure there's a paper on that somewhere. They'll be certainly opportunistic, so if something goes past them, they'll grab it if they're hungry enough.
Yeah, a wonderful thing.
Isn't that extraordinary in itself, though, that we have this animal in the UK, this heavily populated country, and we still know so little about its behaviour within the UK?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's extraordinary.
We were talking earlier, actually, and I'll mention it again, that it's only discovered as a species in this country in 1859. 59, 69.
Do you know? I can't remember the exact date, but I do know where it was discovered.
So
within
the last 150,
170 years.
Yeah. And previously to that, they were just presumed to be sort of slightly odd-looking grass snakes.
So it's a really recent discovery. Yeah. Not much is known about it. And here we are, surrounded by millions of people.
Mm.
So I'm just... I don't know if we've iterated that. I have to have a licence to be able to do this, because the smooth snake and sand lizard are European protected species. It may have been mentioned whilst I was searching for another tin. And
you're holding it very gently.
Like, yeah, I'm holding it very... This one is very, very obliging. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to go over to my bag, and I've got my fingers crossed. I actually have my tape measure in here. Now, I'm going to be honest, this is not actually easy in the field to do this. And we don't always take measurements. But sometimes if you want to see the progress of how an individual that you may encounter frequently is growing, this kind of data is quite important. I'm going to measure this individual, and I gently hold it by the head here.
So gravity is helping.
Gravity helps. It needs to be very relaxed. Not all snakes are as obliging. I just need to wait for it to just...
It's got a bit of a kink around his leg. Just to that stage of...
Okay, so this individual is, as you can see there, is about 520 millimetres. 520 millimetres. That's a pretty reasonable size, yeah. Now I'm measuring from the cloaca, so from the vent to the end of the tail, and it's 120
So basically a fifth, really.
Yeah. And what I want you to do is to write in 122 divided by the figure that...
520.
Yeah. And give me the figure that comes up,
0.23.
0.23, 100% male.
Brilliant.
But broadly speaking, anything below 19% as a ratio... And I'm talking typically 17-18%.
That's the male. So the female has a longer...
It's female. It's female.
Oh, right, sorry, yeah.
And anything sort of up in the upper reaches, 23, 24 and beyond.
And it's interesting seeing it now. And I've got a lot of experience with grass snakes. And you can see grass snakes are similar. And the female have sometimes incredibly short tails.
Yeah.
But it's typical of a male to have almost this... It's sort of lengthening out into a fine taper that...
Yeah. It really does go to a fine point.
Yeah.
It
almost seems a bit showy rather than functional.
Because you are here with licensed handlers, I am able to let you just...
Thank you.
Hold and have a look.
That's fantastic. So Kev's now got hold of this lovely male.
And it is, again, the name obviously comes from... The fact that there's no keels on the scales, so it's
absolutely
incredibly
soft,
smooth. Yeah. And this is a very docile.
Particularly docile one.
The other snakes, both the adder and the grass snake, have a keel, a little ridge down each scale.
So you can feel that if you're running your hands down, okay. Yeah. Hence the smooth snake. Yeah, I thought it just hung out in cool bars and smoked chiton. And
he's got amazing chat-up lines. Yeah.
But I'm jolly glad we saw one. I mean, the conditions right at the moment are absolutely ideal. When we return the snake to the refugia, this is arguably the most important part of the whole process. Because what we don't want to do is to do anything that could harm the snake. And so what you can see I'm about to do here, and I'll try and describe it, is I'm going to return the smooth snake to the edge of the tin, and I'm going to let it look for the darkness underneath, and you're going to see, as I release it, it will head under the tin, and it's going to probably head to the far corner there.
Right, okay.
And so that's now been released. What you absolutely don't do when you're doing surveys...
That's great.
Is that the first time you've seen one?
Never seen a smooth snake before.
I didn't know that. I should have asked that question earlier on. That is terrific for you. I didn't realise.
Oh, really, that's exciting.
Always an excitement. I'm just going to make a couple of notes, if I may, a second.
Yeah, for sure. That's absolutely...
I think as well,
what a beautiful thing. I had no idea what it would look like.
They're charming, aren't they? They really are charming.
I've looked up pictures, but they weren't. The photos don't seem to do them justice.
No, the colours look really flat in pictures, and the pattern doesn't really come through. And also the shine off the scales.
And that was a dull one, Nick says.
When you look around and you see a heathland, particularly outside of when the heather is in bloom. You see the millennia, you see the scrubby gorse, the brown.
So the millennia is this the grass that we see, the dry grass that's sort of...
It doesn't look like much. Some people might think it's a bit scrubby, but it really is sort of like a shallow sea. You can if you were to stop and look closer, and as we know through reptile surveys, but there is all that plant life, all that the insects, the beetle we saw earlier, all of that is moving and having this life within this habitat. So
that's a lovely way to describe it. Yeah,
it's actually quite extraordinary.
A shallow sea.
Oh, brimstone.
Yeah. A brimstone butterfly. Wow.
It's loaded with them. Wonderful. I think what we'll do now, guys, is there's a couple of things. I'd like to take you along a transect, which is actually in the sort of millennia, slightly wetter part of the site, and to see where...
So that's the sandy coloured area over there. This is the sort of grass I'm familiar with in the Brecon Beacons.
There is a mixture of dry, mainly predominantly dry lowland heathland here, but actually there are some areas that are a bit wetter. Don't worry, it's not a bog, I promise you that.
I'm happy with bogs.
So certainly...
I really don't mind enduring anything, because the sheer joy of being out somewhere so refreshingly new as this is So on the verge of this track, there are some beautiful little purple flowers, pink, well, magenta-y flowers in the grass.
I knew we should have brought a botanist along.
Yes.
Nick is right in the middle of the heather, gorse and millennia. There's a huge excitement. It's unwrapping a present.
It is exactly like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. The lifting of the...
Okay, we've arrived at another tin.
Yeah. Will we strike again?
So, that tin is very, 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 very warm. It just goes to show you how... guys, if you want to feel that tin just underneath there so that you can get impressed, you tell me if you think that's hot. You do it with your open hand.
Yeah, I mean, that's warmed up really quickly, because it doesn't feel that warm.
Yeah, I don't think a snake would want to sit under that. No.
That's too hot.
I'm going to surprise you here. The smooth snakes, I have found them under incredibly hot tins. They really are very tolerant of that. It just goes to show that when you do get a little bit of sun, that is very warm, isn't it?
Yeah, especially at this time of year when it's so high, which helps.
Disturbance. Oh, there's a common lizard shot in front of me here. So you just have to keep your eyes peeled all the time.
So two species down.
Two.
You're a third of your way through the...
Is that a linnet?
Yes.
It just sounds...
such a lovely sound.
It's a great sound.
You can see, I'm glad I got it right when I spoke about it earlier on. We actually obviously have here quite a lot of little ephemeral pools.
Yeah.
And we've had quite a lot of rain.
And I believe, Owain, this is millennia grass.
So this is sort of thatched, a sort of thatched humps of millennia, which is very, very dry.
Incredibly rich in invertebrates.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, and it's great cover for lots and lots of wildlife, including reptiles.
It gets nice and warm as well, doesn't it?
And it does look thin. And looking at the environment around here,
I was
to guess what could be under here, and that's always the surprise. I've had two candidates. One is
grass snake,
and the other one is smooth snake. We'll have a look. And neither.
Neither.
Cool. There we go.
Well, just adds to the building tension.
Let's have a look at to another transect. Just going on the roof.
So how were these heaths created then originally? I mean, this is cleared forest or something, or what created this landscape?
Yeah, it's a shifting landscape that was cleared. I think Neolithic times it was cleared and grazed, and things were taken, turf was taken, things like that. And so over time, as the bigger parts were taken out, it became more nutrient poor, more sandy. And then the activities of those Neolithic farmers with removing the turf for burning and for the building, for infrastructure, things like that, that maintained that. And so it became dominated by the low-lying heather plants. But if it is now left to its own devices, it will become a forest through...
Regen of lichens here in the... In the grass, in the Molina. It's amazing.
With the pine as well. Yeah.
So, okay. And then do you clear the trees then fairly regularly?
Yes, yeah, so there is some clearing of the trees. It's in structured programme in patches. So there's always some trees left in to make this mosaic habitat. But they are, when you start to get a small low growth around a tree, some of the smaller plants might be cleared out there in order to maintain... Yeah. The heath, because if it was allowed to succeed with these, you know, mostly invasive pine species, you would lose this wildlife that's become endemic.
The thing is that, and I say this to many people, is that you never ever stop learning. Last year I encountered for the first time a adder taking down prey in real time. It struck at a wren.
Really?
Yeah, and I saw it.
And it got it.
The wren pacified, and then I saw it pretty much consume it, and I'd never actually witnessed that before.
That's
big tick.
So how does that? So yeah, talk me through that.
I was walking along, and I thought, oh, there he is again, Harrison. Interesting. I name those on that particular site, by the way. It's just easy for the database. Yeah. And there this adder was coiled up, and I noticed its tail was flicking.
Is that a sign of it sort of focusing on?
Maybe.
Prey. Yeah.
Caudal
luring is what it's called. Now, sometimes when you come across something that you've not seen before, there is an adrenaline pump, a real excitement. So you have this sort of choice. Do I actually observe or do I photograph and film? Mm. Now, the instinct for a photographer like me is actually to want to film it. But I thought, this is very interesting. And then suddenly... I saw a wren come out from the gorse just to the side in this bare patch. And I thought, now something's going to happen here. There's something going on. So I grabbed the camera, and as I was grabbing the camera, all hell broke loose. Saw Harrison the adder strike the wren, hold on to it until it pacified. And just as that point when it pacified, I got the camera out. And I filmed it, and it's on public record.
Oh, fantastic! And we can find that, can we?
It's on my Flickr page, that particular sequence.
Oh, exciting.
But the thing that's galling is that what I really wanted to capture was actually the caudal lure, because it's never actually really been documented in an adult adder. So I'm hoping this season, because I know where this particular adder hangs out.
Yeah.
I'm hoping if he's a creature of habit, he might perform the same act again, so I can actually get the caudal luring part of it actually on film.
Wiggling his tail, to be like a worm, basically. Or some
network of really wonderful volunteers and enthusiasts, and There's a lot of discussion around that, I remember, on the forums and stuff. When that.
But they wiggle their tail to look like prey, some sort of caterpillar or worm, a bird comes down or some other creature, and they can then...
Should we go to number 75?
Let's do it.
Should we go and see if we can find it?
So here we have, we're back on a broad track running uphill.
I am going to have one other cursory dive into the brush just to have a look, and I'll do is I'll give you a shout if I see anything on this one.
Great, okay. The heath's gone quite quiet now.
It has, it feels like it's...
Actually.
Yeah, where the front coming?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's gone. So Nick has... Oh, and another lizard darted in front of me there. So Nick is holding... That looks like a bootlace. But... He's found another smooth snake. That's a cute little...
This is going to be an interesting one for Kev, this, in some respects.
It's a tiddler.
So this is we would have this as a juvenile a juvenile one. And, you know, lengthwise, it's still quite lengthy, but it's immediately you can see the girth is not as wide as... anything like as the previous one that we actually saw there. You know, we were talking about the concentric spots and dashes down the back to identify individuals. I can say with absolute assuredness that this one has never been recorded by me, certainly.
Wow. It seems to have a stronger definition of around his head.
Well, this one is what I would call a joyous one to have surveyed and then encounter perhaps again in the future, because if you look at the first two markings behind the head, very distinct, and I almost can take a photograph in my head of that, and I would recognise that individual.
And would you say, I mean, I'm going on a grass snake sort of size, that's about 4 years old, maybe?
Ooh, that's a very interesting question. Ageing is quite tricky. I'm going to hedge here and say I would say it's at least 3 years old. Okay, but
so it's not big, so they don't grow fast.
They don't go particularly fast here, but I am going to do some photographs of this one because we want it for the database, obviously.
Yeah, his tongue dashes out and flickers, tasting the air. Beautiful eye. It's got a lovely face, actually. It's a very sweet, gentle face for a snake.
It flatters to deceive, doesn't it? It doesn't look like it would hurt anyone.
So when they're this small, what is it eating? I mean, obviously juvenile reptiles, but will they take other things, insects?
It's exactly that. They have a slight, they sort of, I think it might be called ontogenic, but I can't remember. But basically, as they grow, what they eat varies slightly. So they tend, it starts with the smallest of the reptiles, the smallest of the lizards, and they get, over the years, it's the bigger reptiles to slightly larger snakes. So their diet just shifts slightly in terms of stomach contents.
Yeah, pipit.
Tree pipit singing. And it should be doing its umbrella. There it goes. It's just dropped on the top of that tree.
Okay, there might well be something under here. And there is. There we go. Just have a check. Anything else? And we have quite... Well, don't let me speak here. Let you guys
see. It's much more silvery.
This is another smooth
snake. Yeah, that looks like it has sloughed, I'd say.
I would say approaching sloth, actually.
Okay. I would always bow to your judgment.
Well, I don't know. We can't always... But you can see on the back here, we've got the very, very typical markings. There's nothing particularly odd about those first series of dots or markings down from back from the head towards the tail. Quite round, quite normal looking is the best way to describe that. But certainly I need to make a record of that. I'm intrigued with this one.
Well, whether you've met it before. What sex?
Yeah, what sex? Let's do the measurement, shall we? So talk amongst yourself about the wonderful wildlife here. I'm going to whiz off and do this, and then we'll see. Because
Nick has reminded me not moments ago, actually, just that to say... When it comes to handling these animals and doing these surveys under license, we, for our volunteers, provide all the necessary training in order to be able to do so safely and in order to be able to identify these animals before we allocate sites.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. If anybody would like to get involved, they have to go through that training. But
absolutely,
what a qualification to have. And also what a...
Yeah. I've done the training, and it's fascinating as well. There's some really amazing...
You've done it, yes, of course.
Yes. Look at the head on that. It's almost...
So it's much wider.
It looks...
proportion to the body than the... Gorgeous eyes. The sort of Egyptian sort of pharaoh's eyes.
So what are we going to have? Should we have a little sweepstake here as to guesses? And I'm not going to show you the tape measure now, because I gave it away last time.
That's a 475er, I reckon.
You reckon a 475er?
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Well, trying to see where it's bent
is. I think it's around 530.
Oh. Yeah.
That's over 50 centimetres.
Let's have a look. Now it's playing wrap around the tape measure here. Which is...
It looks really...
quite... Oh, there you go.
Obviously, as a fisherman, I'm prone to exaggeration.
No.
I'm impressed. What did you say?
530.
That is absolutely spot on.
Yeah, well done.
Absolutely spot on to the absolute...
Brilliant.
No, actually, you're wrong. It's 531 if we want to be really accurate.
Oh, yeah.
531.
That's only because it's sticking its tongue out.
So that actually is the biggest specimen that we've had today. Now, here's the interesting thing. I want to just... That's why I was sort of scowling a little bit earlier on, because I didn't want to commit myself to the sex on this one. I wasn't actually 100% sure. Oh, now it is having a little bite at me.
Really?
One.
Okay, how'd it go? Yeah.
And let's commit to what I think it is. Here you go. Oh, it's just bitten me. Now look, can you see that?
Oh, yeah. It absolutely opened its mouth, grabbed the ball of Nick's thumb, and I think it's a female.
Yeah, if I was to, without taking the measurements, have a crack, that was my first instinct.
No, I can see where the cloaca, where the vent is.
Oh, you can
is.
Certainly see the poo coming out of it, that's for certain. Let's have a look. Okay, don't bite me again there. That would be...
Is it painful? Can you feel it?
No, not really. It draws blood, but it doesn't, here comes the rain.
Here comes the rain at last, yeah.
As you can see, when they do get very lively...
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Sorry, I mean, I've never seen that before.
It's massive.
That is really a massive
gape on your finger.
Yeah, it's impressive. Yeah.
Oh, I can actually now smell the poo.
Yeah, and fragrant again in a nice way.
It's much more pleasant than the grass snake.
Yeah, it's nothing like grass. I can't get a waft of it. Grass snake at the beach.
Just gonna. Do you want to do the honours?
I'd
then,
love
Kev?
To.
There you
Thank
go.
You.
Oh, hang on. Sorry, we have to do
oh,
one
photograph.
Thing.
Yep. She's biting you again. Oh.
Yeah. It sounds awful, but I wouldn't mind being bitten just because I'd like to know what it's like.
Well, it's...
She's opening her mouth again. Going to get this. Going to bite you, Kevin.
For the now, our day is almost over with the rain.
Yeah, yes. I think that's. You're really disappointed that she hasn't bitten you.
So find that gap.
Yeah.
Wow. And off she goes. The third.
So you can see where she just... So there's a little bit of drawing apart there.
So it's just like
it's
scratch
so,
from a...
I think we'll... Ooh.
So we're just going to have to beat a hasty retreat because the rain is going to settle in. But we've had an amazing... stroke of fortune to get a morning of three smooth snakes. That's quite a significant part of the UK population.
And so, with heavy rainfall, which we've all become so familiar with this May, we had to run for cover. And that was the end of a really brilliant and a fantastic day for me, seeing Britain's rarest reptile, three of them. And I'm so grateful to Owain Masters and Nick Dobbs of ARC, the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust, who were brilliant. I'm sure that they are stars in the making, those two. And of course, we had our lovely star, Kevin Parr, with his wise words as well. So what a treat. And on the subject of stars, I'm joined in the podcast studio by Jack and Hannah, who helped produce, edit, and create this podcast. Hello.
Hello.
So snakes, Jack, you and I had an excellent snake adventure recently. In fact, this has been a very snaky year, a snaky season with Kevin's adders as well. Hannah, have you ever had the pleasure of an encounter with one of our snakes?
I don't think I've seen a snake. I may have when I was little because there are quite a lot on Gower, but I have had snake adjacent experiences with slow worms.
Oh, really? They're the sort of, I mean, they're the legless lizard. Where did you see your slow worms?
Often in the garden. We're just hanging around. My mum will do some gardening and then they'll end up round her wrist like a bangle because they are so beautiful. Like, they quite short, maybe like the size of your forearm, but they are bronze, like so metallic and beautiful.
People do mistake them for snakes and they do get a bit I think there's a general sort of fear of serpents.
It's an easy mistake to make because how would you know that it was a legless lizard unless you knew?
A totally good point. And we talked about how they originally had legs and they've evolved back to sort of not have legs. It's a really weird thing. So there's sort of parallel evolution, which is they look like a snake, act like a snake, but actually they are from a totally different family of reptiles. Really interesting how that happens. And they are, you know, doing okay, I think, in some areas, but like all Britain's reptiles, I think they're struggling a bit with habitat loss and people's sort of tidy gardens. People pattying over gardens, people not having compost heaps, mowing. I make one appeal to listeners, if you can leave corners of the garden a little bit for nature, you will be doing a huge, huge job for not just the reptiles, but also the stuff they feed on and the birds and that sort of thing. So,
and another thing about leaving a bit of nature to get on with it in a garden is that you will be surprised by the stuff that turns up. There's so much seed and like little things trying to get out all the time that if you just stop, if you just leave it, you'll end up with all sorts of things you never knew were there. It's like all the field weeds that are just in the ground all the time will suddenly be given an opportunity to go for it.
I sort of sometimes look at absolutely finely mown lawns in a little square at some gardens around where I live. And I wonder what do you get from that? They've stopped mowing the local park here and it's all full of flowers. And now there are flocks of jackdaws, starlings, swifts overhead. It's just come alive. And the bee numbers are so many more bees and flies and all sorts of things.
We've got bits like that around where I am. There's quite large chunks of places by paths and stuff and by near roads that have just been left to grow wildly. And they've got little signs on saying we're doing this for the bees. But I think it looks so much nicer than flat grass with the piles of cut grass that have just been left everywhere. It
so
looks
inspiring.
So much better.
Well, I think it's one of the good things that's come out of the pandemic because last year people weren't able to go out and do it. Like the councils didn't have the money or the resource to get these people out there to cut them down. So they were left and people realised like how beautiful and how valuable these little bits of wildness actually are.
When you see a roundabout that's just flat grass, to me makes no sense why that couldn't just be wildflowers, just let it grow a bit, because who really cares what's on a roundabout? And
motorists care about visibility sometimes.
Well, as long as it's not blocking visibility.
Yeah, that's how big it is.
If you've got some sort of wild grass and stuff that's there instead of just the normal flat green grass, to me, just seems like it's going to look a bit nicer because it's a bit more interesting. But also, I guess, for bees as well. If there's a couple of roundabouts in the local area that are good for them, it's almost like a little road for them as well that they can hop between them and get to them. And it's using a space that I think mostly a very sort of boring, maybe just grass with a tree in the middle.
It does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, that someone would, that we'd, our council tax would go on to paying people to use a petrol-driven machine to mow a roundabout when it could just be left for wildflowers. And as you say, a really nice resource for bees. And then the whole food chain is boosted. And I got a big shout out to my local council, Monmouthshire, who are doing a really good job on roundabouts and parks and things like that. So, you know,
listeners, please let us know of good practice around where you are. We love to hear them. We love
pictures.
Your pictures, definitely, and send us the sound of no mowers. Which brings me on to
Council of the Week.
Council of the Yeah, we could do that. Monmouth sure I nominate for this week, but Sound of the Week, where you, our lovely listeners, send in some delightful recordings that you've made in your own area of the sounds of nature. And what have we got this week, chaps?
I've got Sound of the Week this week from Joel Delahunty, and they have moved from Bristol to the glorious New Zealand. They've been keeping up with the podcast while they work at a farm nearby. This recording is of a tui-up in Bay of Islands. Their call is so distinctive and quite varied, but they think it sounds like a blend of R2-D2 and the noise you used to get with dial-up.
Lovely, thank you, Joel. That's a great one, all the way from New Zealand.
So evocative.
Another long distance one. I'm going to put in a claim for Sound of the Week. I'm sorry, I know it should be
you,
the listeners.
No,
but I was out recording.
You get to record all the time.
Fergus's special Sound of the Week.
Yeah, this is an editor's prerogative. So I was out trying to record, and this is one of the challenges of recording nature in the British countryside, having just been to New Zealand there with Joel. You can be out there and a plane will go overhead or someone will start up some petrol-powered device. So it is quite difficult finding some pure bits of just lovely atmosphere and sounds of nature without human interference. Now, that is part of the whole experience, of course, but... And so this, I was up recording wood warblers in my local woodland, and have a listen to this. I thought, gosh, beautiful piece. And this great big military plane came overhead, really low. And as you can hear, but still, it's part of the sound of the countryside. So there we have it. Jack, I believe we've got a little comment on one of the pods.
We have. We've been left a review.
Oh, trepidation.
Exciting.
And it is a good review.
Oh,
hooray!
We got 5 stars.
Oh my goodness.
5.
Informed, relaxed, and close to home. This review is from Christopher. I say it's an amazing podcast. Love the seasonal approach to understanding our countryside and coast. COVID has really made this so relevant to many. It helps you get to know what is on our doorstep. I mean, I guess that's the point. That's lovely.
And I make no excuses for blowing our own trumpet there, because it is a real pleasure getting some feedback and it's exactly what we want to do, is to take people away. Not everybody can get out into the countryside at will, not even us, but when we can, we try and share it. Please do send in your thoughts, reviews, nice reviews. You can leave comments and reviews on whatever podcast provider you use, or send your thoughts directly to me at editor@countryfile.com. Please do send in Sounds of the Week. I just love to hear them and share them with the team here. So that would be great. Before we go, just to go back to the podcast, and I just need to reiterate that all the snake handling by Nick, Kevin, and Owain was done because they're experts and under license. So please do beware when you see reptiles, they're not to be picked up and handled unless you've had training. The good news is that ARC, the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust, take on volunteers and train them. So if you have a passion for getting close to reptiles and helping with their conservation, why not get in touch with ARC at arc-trust.org, and they will take you under their wing, train you up, and you can enjoy days in the field with some of our six wonderful reptiles and all the amphibians we have too. So that seems to me like a fantastic opportunity for anyone who loves nature in the countryside.
Don't try and pick them up anyway. They're so smooth, they're going to slip out your hands.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it for this week. We'll be back next week with more adventures, where we're heading to the east of England and Wicken Fen, one of the oldest nature reserves in Britain. So look forward to the adventures there. But for now, it's goodbye from me and the podcast team.